This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research, and I'm pleased to be speaking today with John Tudor. John pitched in the major leagues between 1979 and 1990, most notably with the Boston Red Sox and St. Louis Cardinals. We are recording this interview with John's permission on February the 13th, 2024. And John, what got you interested in baseball?
I was a kid. That's about it. That's what you did back then. You played baseball, you played football, you played hockey. I grew up in the Northeast. It's just what you did all day long, every day.
And you were in Peabody, and were you a Red Sox fan at that time?
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess. I mean, baseball wasn't on TV every day like it is nowadays back in those days. So, I was just more a fan of playing the game. I did follow the Red Sox when I could.
You also in Little League played first base. Tell us about what it was like to play first base and when you first started pitching.
I pitched all through it. I played first base when I didn't pitch. I mean, that's just what you did. If you weren't pitching, you were playing a position somewhere.
Well, I know you said that ice hockey was your first love. Was that actually in fact true? And were you more inclined to play hockey than you were to play baseball?
Well, it depended upon the season, obviously. There wasn't my hockey career for the most part is playing pond hockey in the wintertime. So at that time of year, obviously up in the Boston area, there's not much baseball going on in December, January, February, March. So we moved to other sports. We just went from one sport to another as they came up. Hockey is my first love. That just unfortunately wasn't real good at it. I'm not sure what else to say about that.
You went to Peabody High School. You're at that time 6 foot 185. Tell us about your high school career playing baseball.
Well, at that point was not 6 foot 185. I'm probably closer to 5'10", 5'11", about 150. My high school career was pretty nondescript. I didn't really play much in high school. I was I started some games my senior year, but I was pretty much a bench warmer watching, and I just loved the game, liked being around the game, and just kind of stayed with it. I mean, I tell people all the time, I'm glad that lacrosse had not come into the picture at that point up there, because I probably would have, it's a sport I probably would have been drawn to and probably would have stopped playing baseball.
You went on to North Shore Community College in Danvers. You were the MVP of your team in 1973. Tell us about that season.
No, God, I don't know. It was my, first year in college, obviously. I was a freshman. It's just a little junior college team. I mean, we had some good players, and we had fun with it. I mean, that's just another scenario. I pitched and played first base, and MVP could have been one of a number of guys on that team, and coaches happened to pick me.
You went on to Georgia Southern College, joined the baseball team as a walk-on, had success there. At what point did you start to think that maybe the major leagues were within reach?
Oh, I don't know. Not really until I got into professional baseball, into really higher in the organization with the Red Sox. I started to think, probably in my second year in Pawtucket that I might have a chance. And up until that point, I was a fill-in player for the most part. I pitched out of the bullpen and would get some starts later in the year, maybe when somebody got hurt. And had the opportunity to pitch in a game against the Red Sox in an exhibition game in Pawtucket in, was able to get some notice there and put on the roster the next spring.
You know, the Mets had selected you in the 21st round of the amateur draft, but you didn't sign. And you were eligible for the secondary phase in 76. And the Red Sox took you. How did you feel?
I was good. I mean, I signed, I was actually into my senior year at Southern at that time. And I just thought, obviously, you know, back then there were two drafts. There was the January draft. And I just kind of decided at that point that, maybe I should sign here this time. I might not get this chance again. And so I did.
In your first 3 years in Boston's minor league system, you spent a lot of time in the bullpen. I'm sure you were glad to have the opportunity to pitch. Did you have any dislike of being in the bullpen?
No, I mean, I took the ball when they gave me the ball. You know, I mean, that's about the extent of it. I wasn't a high draft choice, so there were guys obviously in front of me as far as that went, and just tried to take advantage of the opportunity when it came to me. And I got to start some games my first year in A-ball towards the end of the year, and had a decent year. And then I was lucky; I kept moving up in the system and never really got stagnated in any one place. So it it kind of made it easy to kind of hang on to it for a little while longer.
What kind of pitcher were you at that time? Obviously you had a great fastball, but you also relied on your breaking pitches. If someone had seen you pitch back then, what kind of pitcher would they have seen?
I was more power pitcher back in those days. I didn't really have a very good breaking ball. I struggled with a breaking ball really my whole career, trying to find something that worked. And, I came up to the big leagues throwing probably, low 90s, topping out probably around 93 or so. And so I had a pretty good arm. I was, lucky enough to be left-handed and was a little bit of a rare commodity back in those days. And
If I started a game back in those days, I was probably throwing 80% fastballs and
trying to mix in a curveball here and there. I didn't really find the changeup until a little bit later in my career.
There wasn't as much emphasis on using radar guns then. Did people care how hard you were throwing the way they do today?
No, I don't think they certainly cared or it made you get noticed a little bit better, but it wasn't as much of a prerequisite as it is now. The emphasis back in those days are can you win? Can you get people out? And unfortunately, in a game today that's partially run by people that never played the game, it's easy to scout a game with a radar gun. It's easy to scout a pitcher with a radar gun. It's easy. It's a lot more difficult to, I guess you have to have a feel for the game or understanding of the game in order to see the little variables in a person that is he a winner? Is he not a winner?
When you were at Pawtucket, you were managed by Joe Morgan. And tell us both about what it was like to be managed by Joe and any work that he did with you there.
Joe didn't do much work with me. When I came up in the Red Sox organization or when I came up through the minor leagues, there were no full-time pitching coaches at places. Even in Pawtucket, all we had was a rover that came through, three or four times a year. And the reality of it is they spent more time with the higher draft picks than they did with guys like me. So I think I actually benefited from not having guys constantly trying to teach me something, and we kind of learned from each other. And I think it makes things stick a little bit better when you're learning from the guy in the locker next year rather than some guy who's coming in and seeing you once every 3 months or once every 2 months.
Did you have any pitchers that you watched and you said, I really want to be able to pitch like this particular player?
I think that Scotty McGregor with the Orioles was a guy that I kind of emulated a little bit. He was kind of my style of pitcher, although he had the big curveball. But I kind of liked his mechanics, and I liked the way he handled himself on the mound. And he's probably really the one guy that I really watched and kind of paid attention to, tried to learn from.
During the winter in 1978 and 79, you played in the Dominican League. There were several major leaguers who were there at the time, whether it's Cliff Johnson or Mark Clear. It seemed as though that experience really helped you to grow and set you on a course toward the major leagues. Is that a fair assessment?
No, I really don't think it is, because when I went down to the Dominican in 79, I hadn't been on the mound in probably 6 or 8 weeks because the minor league season had ended obviously at the end of August. And they threw me right into the fire. And my first start there was a complete game shutout. And that pretty much was the end of me for the spring. For the winter, my shoulder started bothering me, and I ended up, I think I started one more game and ended up going home shortly afterwards. I'm drawing a blank on his first name. McNamara was the manager down there, and had gotten John McNamara had gotten the job down there and had gotten the Cincinnati job when we were there, and he had left. So when he left, I asked him if I could leave as well, and I did. And I went back there again after the 81 season, the year of the strike, and had a good winter down there. I think that is what kind of maybe set me a little bit more on a course. I was already in the big leagues at that time, but that kind of established me a little bit more as a possible big league pitcher, I think.
You made your major league debut August 16th, 1979 in Boston. I know that you had some of your friends from Peabody who were there. Tell us about your first game.
not very memorable, to be honest with you, other than the fact that it was my first game. I think I only lasted maybe 3 or 4 innings, gave up 3 or 4 runs. I can't remember exactly, to be honest with you. Definitely a little bit of a nervous time, and it was fun to have my friends there, and also a little bit challenging with them standing over the bullpen rail in Fenway, you know, yelling at me while I'm warming up. But yeah, it was good. It was good to get that start under my belt, that year was that end of the year was not great, but it again. Kind of put me on the radar, I guess, a little bit, for good or for bad.
When you did get your first win in Boston in September over the Detroit Tigers, you were sharp with your breaking ball and your fastball. And I wanted to ask you about just having command of those pitches, because you have a reputation as always having, you know, great command of all your pitches. And what's the key to having that kind of control?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's just repetition. You know, my command was not as good in those early days as it was later on. Like I said, I was more power pitcher back in those days. It was a here it is, hit it attitude. I developed more control later on again with the opportunity to get out there and pitch every fifth day or fourth day with the Cardinals for a little while.
Was your shoulder giving you any trouble at that time? I know you had hurt it at Georgia Southern.
Yeah, my shoulder bothered me my whole career, pretty much. I went in and out with shoulder soreness, pretty much throughout my whole career. I went through streaks where it didn't bother me and through streaks where it bothered me every time out. And it's just the nature of the beast.
Tell us about some of your Red Sox teammates when, you get up to the team and let's just say Carl Yastrzemski. What was he like as a person and as a player from your perspective?
Well, when I first came to the Red Sox, they were pretty much an all-star team with Yaz and Jimmy Rice and Evans and Burleson and Butch Hobson and, Freddie Lynn and, it was Carlton Fisk. It was an all-star team. And, for the pitching staff was Eckersley and Mike Torres and Tom Bergmeier. And, Red Sox back in those days were they described them as 25 guys, 25 caps. And it was rookies back in those days were seen and, were expected to be seen and not heard. So that's kind of what I tried to do. I had a couple of friends of mine in Glenn Hoffman and Dave Stapleton who were there at the time that I had played with in the minor leagues and been roommates with. And so the three of us really, and maybe one or two other guys kind of hung together, especially on the road. And it was a challenging time for all of us just to try and stay in the big leagues.
And a particular highlight for you was in May of 83 versus the Blue Jays. You pitched the first of your two career one hitters. Tell us about that game.
I had no idea. It's a start. I don't remember the game. I remember the one hit was early in the game and it was a ground ball between short and third. But like I said, the hit came in probably the fourth inning, so it's not like I was flirting with a no hitter and it got broken up.
Do pitchers pay attention to those things? I know you always try and go out and give your best effort, but whether you give up one hit or three hits, does it really make a difference if you aren't giving up runs?
No, I don't think it does. I didn't have no hit stuff. I was trying to get through nine innings if I could, trying to get a win and keep our team in the game as best I could. That was, my strategy through it all. I think that's pretty much any pitcher's strategy.
What do you consider the highlight of your time in Boston, and what did you learn from being in Boston?
What was that? You broke up.
I said, what do you consider the highlight of your time in Boston, and what did you learn the most from pitching in Boston?
I mean, I think you just gain experience from pitching in the big leagues, period. I don't know that I learned anything necessarily from pitching, in particular in Boston. But highlight, weren't a lot of highlights. I mean, I was, there to see Yaz's, 400th home run, and I think it was his 400th and his 3,000th hit. So those were kind of highlights. And but as far as, personally, I was a guy just trying to hang on, trying to get year to year. And
in terms of pitching in Fenway Park as a left-hander, how difficult was it, in fact? And did you make any particular adjustments that made a difference when you were pitching in Fenway?
No, I didn't change anything pitching in Fenway. I think the left-hander in Fenway thing is a little bit overblown, or at least I thought it was back in those days. I mean, the wall gives and the wall takes. You get the wall scraper doubles or a few cheap home runs, but there's also those rocket line drives that hit off the top of the wall that ends up being singles or doubles that normally would have been a home run. So I think that it's probably a 50-50 proposition there as far as giving up home runs in the wall. The wall is pretty close as in center field. It was a big league stop for me. So that was the whole thing, was to be the ability, opportunity to pitch in the big leagues and which was obviously a dream, especially as I grew up.
In December of 1983, you're traded to the Pittsburgh Pirates in return for Mike Eastler. Did you expect that the trade was coming, and what did you think of it when it did?
No, I didn't know it was coming. At the time, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure what I thought of it. Just as another opportunity, I guess. The Pirates that year were expected to be a decent team, so I thought it would be a good opportunity. As it turned out, we were not. Unfortunately, we were actually pretty bad. And but it gave me the opportunity to again continue to pitch in the big leagues, and I think it made me appreciate defense and runs, because we struggled to score runs, we struggled to catch the ball in Pittsburgh, and it made me appreciate every runner that was on base and try to keep them from scoring, because it didn't take much, didn't take very many runs to get you beat there or get you out of a game, because the National League was a little bit different in that you got to this, you know, sixth or seventh inning of a National League game, if you're losing 1-2 or 2-1, then you got pinch hit for and you're out of the game, no matter how good you're pitching. So it made a difference from that standpoint. Like I said, it made me appreciate and made me know that runs given up should be eliminated if possible.
Now, after you had one season in Pittsburgh, and after that, you go to St. Louis, and that obviously was a big turning point in your career.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can remember sitting in a dugout with the Pirates when we were in St. Louis, and, you know, seeing the sea of red in the stands and watching those guys play defense and watching them run, saying, boy, wouldn't this be fun? And then I never thought that we kind of knew the Pirates with the pitching staff with the Pirates, because we had a really good pitching staff over there with Rick Rhodes and Larry McWilliams, John Candelaria, Jose De Leon. That was our starting staff was really good, and we knew one of us was going to be gone because they needed to find a batter too. And but I never thought it would be me, because I had just gotten there. And I didn't think that they would trade me, only because, like I said, I had just gotten there, and that would maybe seem like they'd made a mistake and gotten rid of a pretty good hitter in Mike Easler for an arm that they, you know, as it turned out, did not really need.
And Whitey Herzog.
But St. Louis was. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Whitey Herzog had said when you got there that he liked pitchers who were tough and who knew how to pitch in Fenway Park. Tell us about your interactions with Whitey Herzog, what he was like as a manager, and how he helped to coach you.
Whitey was great. Whitey was a player's manager. If you went out there and gave effort and then Whitey, he had no problems with Whitey. He gave me the opportunity and to come over there, which was great. And he also stayed with me during some difficult times early in the season. He very easily could have given up on me that first part of the season. And then who knows what would have happened. He's, you know, like I said, he stayed with me and gave me the opportunity to pitch. And the thing I admire most about Whitey is he was very even tempered. So long as you gave him a chance, he gave you a chance.
Now, the early part of the season is well chronicled. You were 1-7 with a 3.74 ERA. What happened at the beginning of the season?
I wasn't getting anybody out apparently. And I had some games that I could have won and I didn't. And, it just kind of snowballed for a while, and luckily we were able to right the ship. That was such a good, team, for me, it was a matter of, you know, getting my act together and getting a little bit more control of the strike zone and making guys put the ball in play, because, you know, mistakes that I made, that we made as pitchers over there in St. Louis, a lot of times didn't show up in the scorebook. So long as you could keep it in the ballpark, those guys were going to catch it somehow. and it was they were a lot of fun to watch.
I had read that you'd had some issues with where you were releasing the ball at that time, and that there was a coach, Dave Betancourt, who had watched on television and had corrected an issue with your delivery. Is that true? And what exactly did you change, if so?
It wasn't a release scenario. It was, and Dave was a teammate of mine in high school. And we talked occasionally, and he had just mentioned something to me as far as a gathering point, which is a like just a little bit of a pause at the top of my delivery. He kind of said, "Hey, looks like you're kind of rushing through this." And Mike Rourke and I had been working on stuff in between starts for weeks, and just couldn't put a finger on it. Mike had really not seen much of me. And so didn't really know my mechanics. And once we were able to figure to maybe put a finger on something, then I don't know. I don't know if that was all it or just got lucky or what the story was. But yeah, we finally got it together and kind of went on a pretty good run.
And you had an incredible streak in 26 starts. You had a 1.37 ERA, losing only one. And your changeup was especially effective. Tell us about that pitch and also pitching inside, which seemed to also to be a big part of your effectiveness.
I think it's a big part of anybody's effectiveness, pitching inside part of it. You have to do that. You have to be able to keep hitters off the outside part of the plate. Especially somebody like me who kind of lived out there, not only with the fastball, but with the changeup. And I was a two pitch pitcher. I was a fastball changeup guy to righties and a fastball with slurve to lefties. After I left Boston, I'll bet I didn't throw two curveballs to a right-handed hitter the rest of my career. So it was, the changeup became a really big pitch for me. I just, you know, I got pretty good control of it and really just wasn't afraid to throw it in any situation, in any count. So it made a big difference. It kind of got guys off my fastball a little bit and just kind of gave me another weapon.
You had 10 shutouts during that run. I assume that the mentality you had was that every time you started a game, you wanted to finish it. It seems as though very unlikely that anyone's going to challenge that anytime soon, given that pitchers do not pitch nine innings. What's the key to pacing yourself over nine innings so that you can pitch a complete game and pitch a shutout?
I don't think there's any such thing as pacing. If pitchers pace themselves, I'd be very surprised. And as far as the 10 shutouts and somebody chasing it, there's nothing to chase. It's not a record of any kind. It was just a really good year for me. And I think every starting pitcher back then that walked out onto the mound, walked out there with the intent of walking off the mound after the ninth inning. It's not the case anymore. The game has changed considerably, some for the good, some for the not so good. But that was the mentality back then. If you were pitching good, you were in the game. Bottom line, you weren't pitching good, they took you out. You know, nowadays these guys walk off the mound and fifth or sixth inning, you know, tapping their heart and thanking God that they got through five innings. And that just, you know, that wasn't the game. It wasn't the way the game was run back then. I don't begrudge them anything. Get away with it. We didn't go out there with the intent of coming off the mound until it was over.
How did you train? In other words, were you doing a lot of weightlifting in order to stay in the game, or was pitching itself what got you through nine innings?
Yeah, pitching itself is what got you through. Weight training back in those days for pitchers was kind of taboo. With the exception of maybe some cuff weights, you know, like light shoulder type exercises, and even those came in you know, kind of midway through my career. Pitchers weren't expected to lift weights. It was deemed to be not conducive to the flexibility that pitchers needed. For me, it was the pitching aspect of it. You know, if I was out there getting, you know, going, you know, 7, 8, 9 innings every start, then I maintained my fitness.
One of the more memorable games you had that season was pitching against Dwight Gooden, where you both had 9 scoreless innings. And after the game, you were particularly praiseworthy of Gooden, saying that you thought he deserved to win the Cy Young that year. Tell us about both that game and Dwight Gooden.
That game was one of several games we had with the Mets that were like that. I think I had three or four starts against the Mets, like just like that one almost. They weren't, that was the only one against Dwight. I had one later on in the year where I threw 10 shutout innings on my second to last start of the year against Ronnie Darling, and he threw 9, and we ended up losing the game in the 11th inning. It was a game, you know. I mean, I didn't do anything different, and it was just during that streak where it seemed like whatever I did was right. And Gooden was a great pitcher, you know. Obviously, he was, you know, his second year of his career at that point, and very much a power pitcher with a big overhand curveball. And I don't know, and I've met Doc, but I don't know him personally. He was a great talent.
It sounds as though whether you're pitching a big game or any game, you're approaching it the same way, that your mental approach really doesn't change, and you're just trying to pitch your game.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you come into situations sometimes where you know you're going to be in a tight game, and you're more inclined not to maybe try and let a runner score from third base with less than 2 outs early in the game or something just to get an out. You know you're going to be in a tight game, and it kind of makes you bear down a little bit more. But my approach was pretty much the same all the time. I mean, I approached each hitter as an individual hitter for the most part, but I also concentrated on doing what was right for me, not so much what was right for a particular hitter. And just as an example, if a hitter was a good off-speed hitter, didn't mean that I didn't throw him a changeup. Today, with all this analytics and sabermetrics stuff, you know, if all that stuff shows that Mike Trout is a great off-speed hitter, I don't know if he is or not, then they don't throw off-speed stuff. But if I'm an off-speed type pitcher and that's my strength, then I still have to do that. I have to make it work, and I just have to maybe try and use his tendencies against him in those type situations.
That 85 Cardinals team won 101 games. What do you feel were the main reasons that team played so well and had such great success?
Well, there's no doubt that team had great success because of its speed and defense. You know, Whitey was a great tactician and put people in positions where they could be successful and gave them the opportunity to succeed. But that team with its speed and with its team defense, like I said, they didn't beat themselves very often. And as a pitcher, our jobs were, you know, go out there, throw strikes, make hitters put the ball in play, and give those guys a chance to play in the field. And that's what I tried to do, and that's what I think all of us tried to do. And it was a fun team to watch, you know, with the way those guys, again, they played defense and stealing bases. I mean, I couldn't even imagine how many times we were winning 1-0 after the first inning and didn't have a hit. You know, just because Coleman got walked, stole second, stole third, and scored on a ground ball to second base. You know, and that's was the nature of our game. It was a very unselfish team. a guy wasn't trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark with Vince on third base and one or no outs. They were just trying to get him in if that meant hitting a ground ball and giving themselves up and making an out, hitting a ground ball to second base with the infield back and Vince scores, then that's what they did. And that's what made that team so good and what makes the game different now is I don't think hitters really give themselves up in those scenarios. They're all worried about their own individual stats. And I'm saying that as an outsider, someone that's not in the dugout, that's my impression of the game today.
And with Vince Coleman having 110 stolen bases, only one player on that Cardinals team had as many as 20 home runs, and that was Jack Clark.
Right. Yeah. And, Tommy Herr drove in 110 runs or something like that with less than 10 home runs. You know, so that's the unselfishness that I'm talking about is, you know, Tommy may have been, I can't remember, Tommy hit third maybe in that lineup, I think behind Ozzie, you know, so it would be, he might even hit second. I can't remember exactly what the lineup was, but you know, Tommy's probably got 20 RBIs on ground balls to second base or shortstop because Vince, again, had stolen second, stolen third, or hit a double and stolen third or whatever, and then, you know, scored on a ground ball or scored on a sac fly, you know.
At the time, many people made an issue of the field, the Busch Stadium field, saying that, you know, you could, it was the kind of thing that changed baseball because you could bounce a ball high on it or bunt down it and so on. Then it was just different than playing baseball on grass. What are your feelings about the field and its effect on that team?
Well, I think the field definitely had an effect, but it's not like it's the only turf field in the league. You know, there were probably half the team, probably half the fields in the league were turf back in those days. Maybe not quite half, but a lot of them. The field definitely played a role, especially defensively, because it gave our infielders a true bounce. But it didn't give our infielders any more of an advantage than it gave the other team's infielders. So. I don't think that Busch Stadium played any role in the success of that team other than the fact that it was an AstroTurf field. You know, the high bounces as a pitcher, they hurt you just as much as they help you sometimes because, you know, you give up a little flare hit to right field or left field and it's a high fly ball. If it bounces in front of the outfielder, It takes that 15 foot bounce up in the air and the guy ends up with a double instead of a single. So, you know, all that stuff kind of goes both ways.
And for someone who didn't see him play, what was it like to observe Ozzie Smith in the field?
No, Ozzie was incredible. Ozzie was probably the hardest worker on the team. I mean, Ozzie was taking ground balls. I don't know how many he took every day, but he took them in all kinds of different scenarios, from at him to in the hole to turning double plays to, you know, to the high chops, that kind of the in between chops that you're talking about. He probably took 50 ground balls during batting practice every day. You know, more than a handful of times where with somebody on first base, if a ground ball was hit back up the middle towards me, I just would get my glove out of the way and say, okay, Ozzie, it's all yours. Go get them, you know, and take myself out of the scenario. And, you know, he was usually in the right place at the right time.
And but Willie McGee,
that whole defense was outstanding, you know, between our infield defense with Terry Pendleton, who was probably the best third baseman I ever played with, and Tommy Herr, I'd say the same thing for him at second base, and in the outfield with Coleman, McGee and Van Slyke, there weren't a whole lot of holes in that defense.
And I was going to say that Willie McGee ran down so many balls in the gaps during that season. I feel as though his defense is underappreciated.
Yeah, not just him, like I said, but Vince was the same way. You know, Vince wasn't quite as gifted a defensive player as Willie was, but he was still pretty darn good. And, you know, Andy Van Slyke was as good a right fielder as I ever played with that time, because he was still playing right field back in those days with us, you know, before he went over to Pittsburgh. But you think about those three outfielders out there, and, you know, here, and there's a pitcher, like I said before, here it is, hit it. As long as I keep it in the ballpark, you know, pretty good chance they're going to catch it.
And what do you recall about Vince Coleman's injury before the World Series?
Yeah, it was in the playoffs. It was game four of the playoffs against the Dodgers. I actually started that game. We had some rain. I had some rain early, and they were putting the tarp on him. And back in St. Louis in those days, the tarp was automated. It kind of came up from underground, and I did not see it actually happen. I was coming out onto the field for batting practice when they were kind of carrying Vince in. So that made a significant impact on us offensively, obviously. We were able to get through the Dodger series, but just weren't able to develop any kind of an offense against the Royals, because that made a losing Vince took a big hole out of our lineup.
Tell us about the 1985 World Series and what you remember about it.
I just remember Game 7 that I sucked. So that's about the most of what I remember of it. I have a tendency to remember those types of things rather than the other ones.
I know in that final game, you had pitched twice before. Is there a point, especially after a long season, when you really feel it in your arm?
I don't know if that had anything to do with it. I'm not blaming that. I just pitched poorly. Bottom line, didn't get the job done. And I'm not the only one that had gone through a long season. So I'm sure Saber Hagen had a bunch of starts as well.
Now, I know the next season in 86, you started to have shoulder stiffness, and you mentioned how your shoulder had given you trouble throughout your career. How were you doing at that point?
You know, day to day. You know, I think I made most of my starts in 86, because at the end of the year, I think they shut me down towards the end of the year in 86 for the last 2 or 3 weeks. But yeah, I mean, pitching's a challenge. It's wear and tear on your body, and it you know, sometimes some guys have more luck, you know, staying healthy than others do. I unfortunately was you know, had certain bouts of injury throughout my career, and you know, I'm just grateful for the starts I was able to make.
You did have shoulder surgery in early 1987, and techniques were not as advanced as they are now. How did you go through that surgery?
I just had orthoscopic surgery to clean it up a little bit, and I think I made my first start sometime in probably late April or something like that. I can't remember exactly when it was, but I... it was one of a few surgeries.
And then you had the incident with Barry Lyons also early in that season, where he was by the dugout and you suffered a broken leg. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, he just was chasing a foul ball and came into the dugout and hit me. That's about the extent of it.
I know you've read that if you were not there, he might have gotten hurt himself. So,
well, I mean, that's the reason for trying to help him, right? So,
yeah. I get it. So you spent you did have some time on the disabled list in 1988, but you also were pitching pretty well at times during that season, and then you were traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers. What was it like joining that team? Because the Dodgers, you know, had quite a collection of great players too.
Yeah, it was a good team. I mean, yeah, the 88 season for me was a little bit up and down. We struggled in St. Louis to score runs. We were still playing good defense, still doing all the other little things. But for some reason, with almost the exact same team, we just really had a hard time getting runs across the plate. Going over to the Dodgers was good. I mean, it was a fun team to be around. They were a good group of guys. You know, with Gibson and Orel Hershiser and Mike Marshall, you know, a lot of other guys, Mike Socha, just, you know, good baseball people. And, you know, Gibby was the heartbeat, of that team. And Hershiser had his historic year, breaking Drysdale's record. So it was fun to be part of what ended up being a World Series winning team. But I didn't really participate that much to it.
Although you did pitch in the World Series. And
if you want to call it that, yeah.
I know you were there for a short period of time. You certainly witnessed the Gibson home run. Tell us about what you recall from that.
I actually have been sitting with Gibby in the video room, kind of watching the game. I like to watch games on in the video room. It kind of gave you an opportunity to kind of see hitters approach and how, you know, and how they react to certain pitches and where their weaknesses were. And I have obviously had not seen the A's prior to, you know, to that. So I was trying to get a feel for them because I knew I was starting that first game back in Oakland. And then, you know, he left and said he's going to go warm up. And it kind of caught me by surprise because he could just barely walk, let alone go up and hit. You can never count Kirk Gibson out. You know, he's one of those guys where, you know, he just never quits. You know, he's just the ultimate competitor, and was a great teammate and a great leader on that team. You know, he changed the culture of that Dodger team at that point. I was, you know, it was obviously fun to watch.
You mentioned a little about facing the Oakland team. That was a formidable lineup. I know that you struck out Mark McGwire during when you were in the World Series. That team was a powerhouse, and were the Dodgers at that point intimidated in any way, or were they confident?
I don't think teams get intimidated. Big league players don't get intimidated. I mean, if they do, they don't belong there. You take a team, you know, two guys like McGwire and Canseco, those you know, big hitters that were in their lineup, and Henderson was there, and they had some pretty good hitters, but we had some pretty good pitchers too. You know, I unfortunately hurt my elbow in the first inning of that game, and I was able to kind of battle through, you know, an inning and a third of it. But my last pitch to McGwire was a high fastball at about 70 miles an hour, because that was the end of the day for me. It was like I said, that Dodger team was a no quit. They took what Gibson taught them. You know, they don't give up, keep battling. You know, with guys like like I said, Socha, Mickey Hatcher, who was just another gamer. You know, and it was a fun team to be around. They were a good group. They were a really, really good group of guys too. There was no big egos left in that locker room.
And you did have some work done on your shoulder. You're back in action by mid-1989, and then you would go on to join the Cardinals again. But you were a different kind of pitcher at that time. You didn't have the same fastball that you did before. You were throwing, 80 miles an hour or so. Is this a situation where you really knowing how to pitch made the difference?
Yeah, I think it did. My shoulder was really bad at that point. I think I pitched on, like you said, control and a lot on reputation. I think, I was a guy that hitters knew, wasn't afraid to throw the ball inside. Although by the time I got to that point, I was struggling to get the ball inside, but it was still in the back of hitters' minds. And I think it was also a factor that I was literally out of hitting speed. I wasn't a comfortable hitting speed at 80 miles an hour, and sometimes less than that with big league hitters. They had a difficult time adjusting to that velocity, and for some reason that made me successful. I think I made the comment one time I'd have a hard time getting a high school team out right now, but I can get big league hitters out. And again, it was just because of that, because I was not a comfortable speed to hit at.
Now, when you did eventually retire, was it something that had been on your mind for a period of time?
Oh, I had thought about it for a little while, but the game had gotten to the point where it wasn't fun for me anymore because of my physical problems with my shoulder. And I quite frankly had gotten to the point where, when I was able to go out there, I was only able to go out there for six innings. And like I said, back in those days, when we took the mound, I was going out there with the intent of trying to go nine and becoming a six inning pitcher and putting three innings on the bullpen every time I started it. But the majority of it was the fact that, like I said, it wasn't fun because my shoulder hurt all the time, and it was time. Had a pretty good year, but it was time.
I know you returned to Massachusetts initially after retiring. What have you done since leaving Major League Baseball as a player?
I coached for a little while in the minor leagues and started a family, and my kids are all, grown up now, and we're living in Florida right now. We've been kind of here and there. We were in Mass for a long time. I grew up there, so it was a good place to be.
Do you still follow Major League Baseball closely?
Closely? No, I never did follow it closely. Even as a kid, I didn't follow it closely because, like I said, it wasn't on TV all the time. We were always out in the parks playing, whether day or night. If it was nighttime, I was out playing basketball on a basketball court somewhere. I never really watched games. Games weren't really on in my house. My dad wasn't a sports fan, so baseball games weren't on the TV even when they were on. We spent our time, outside the house. Unlike what takes place in today's world with the kids, which is unfortunate, but that's about it. I coached my kids in baseball and in hockey, while they were growing up, and I'm sure they would have mixed reactions to those experiences, but it was fun for me.
In terms of modern baseball, even if you don't follow it closely, is there any particular player or a pitcher that you look at and you particularly admire or appreciate?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think you watch, you see certain guys. I mean, I follow the Cardinals every now and then. So a guy like Adam Wainwright or Chris Carpenter, right? Like I get two of them confused. We're guys that I followed with the Cardinals, a guy like Clayton Kershaw, who's just a freak, and guys like that go out there and perform day in and day out, and, you know, take the ball when it's handed to them. You know, those are the guys that I kind of admire. I was happy to see, you know, Wainwright get his wins and the 200th win. And, but, you know, like I said, I don't follow the game that much. The game's different. The game's different on the mound. It's a different game.
With all of these relievers coming in, I imagine that would have been very difficult for you if you're pitching a good game. And they had decided before the game had started that you were only going to be allowed to go five innings, that would have been very both deflating, and it would have kind of changed the core mission of what a pitcher does.
Yeah, definitely would have. I mean, I mean, like I said, I grew up in a different era. I grew up in an era again where you're out there until you weren't out there. And, you know, today's game, like I said before, with the game being run by guys that never played the game, you get to the, you know, even to the point of starting a reliever and then bringing the starter in, which, just to me, it's just reinventing a game that's not broken. You know, is everybody, they got to put their spin on it. They got to find a way to, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, I mean, I just think it's different. And for good or for bad, there's so much money in the game right now that they protect these guys, and they should protect them to a certain point. But you also can't take away the competitiveness that professional athletes should have. And I think they do that to a certain point on the mound. You know, they know they've only going to go five innings, so it's, you know, if they've gone six, they've exceeded everybody's expectation. It's a different game, but it is what it is. And I have no doubt that the guys pitching in today's game, given the opportunity, could readjust and become longer and, you know, deeper into the game type pitchers. But it's those choices are taken away from them.
You were known as a very intense and competitive player. And I wanted to get your assessment of to what extent you feel that is true. And if true, does it take away from the intelligence that's also required to be a good pitcher? Because you had that too.
I don't know how they're mutually exclusive. I'm definitely a very competitive person. I've always been that way. Like I said, I grew up playing every sport, you know, so, and we played every day and we played to win, you know, I mean, they didn't give participation trophies back in those days, you know, so it was, but I don't see how being competitive could take away from someone that's intelligent or that's a smart pitcher, because, you know, certainly guys like Curtin Kleyshaw or Adam Wainwright, they're certainly competitive people when they're on the mound, and they're certain, and especially Wainwright. I don't know Kershaw, but Wainwright certainly is competitive, so and smart, you know, because, you know, he's not a guy throwing 98. He's thinking his way through the game as well. So I guess I don't really understand the question.
But I guess I meant it in the way of, do people not give enough attention to your intelligence because they focus upon your competitiveness?
No, I mean, you could be the most competitive guy in the world and not be successful. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of pitchers coming up through the minor leagues that are very competitive, but for whatever reason, weren't able to make the adjustments either in their mechanics or in their approach to get them to the next level. I don't see those things as mutually exclusive, and I don't see any reason why anyone would doubt someone's intelligence because they're competitive. I don't know.
It when you were pitching, what was your mental approach to pitching? And I guess I ask in the sense of, were you keeping, let's say, notebooks on particular players? Were you reading scouting reports consistently, or were you in the moment deciding what to throw and how to approach particular hitters?
Yeah, I think I was much more an in the moment kind of guy. I did not keep books. I did not do that. I pitched primarily to my strengths, and after a little while, you've seen guys so many times that you kind of know what their tendencies are, and you just have to you understand the situation, and you understand what the hitter's trying to do in the situation, and you pitch accordingly. But yeah, no, I did not keep a book, or we used to get scouting reports that would come out to the media. I'd read them before the game. And the only thing I wanted to know really about a hitter is, does he want to hit first pitch? And if he gets on base, does he want to run? Those are the only two things I really wanted to know about a hitter. You know, what kind of is he on a good streak? Is he, you know, or is he 0 for his last, you know, 15? You know, those are really the things I looked at. We went over teams before every series, but a lot of what was said in the meetings didn't really even apply to me because I was a little bit different type of pitcher than some of the other guys were.
What moment do you remember most fondly from your career, and how would you like others to remember your career?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, most fondly, I don't know. I really don't. I mean, there were a lot of good moments. There were a lot of bad moments. It's just that, again, that's the nature of the game, and it's, if you play it long enough, you've had some good moments, and you've been beat up a bunch of times if you play the game long enough. And I don't know. I don't know that I could put a fondest moment on it. You know, I know that my least fun moment would be Game 7 of the 85 World Series, but beyond that, I don't know. And I don't remember the second part of that question.
A second part was, how would you like people to remember your career years from now?
As they will. You know, it's not my job or my inclination to worry about what other people think. My job at the time was to get out there and try and get the job done, try and support my teammates, try and give them a chance to win. And so that's what I did. I was a competitor, and I tried my darndest to give our team a chance to win. I went out there, and I tell people all the time, I went out there with the attitude, it's going to be a fast game for me one way or the other. You know, you're going to get my best effort every time I go out there. Sometimes it's not going to be very good, but it's always going to be my best effort. And I think that was my approach to the game. Just do what you do and just never. And I used to say it to my kids, you don't ever want to walk off the field or off the rink or off the court or whatever it was, thinking, geez, if I'd only given a little bit better effort, maybe the results would have been different. You don't want that to happen. You always want to know that whatever you did on that particular day was your best effort. And so long as that is the case, then you shouldn't have any reason to look back on it. Usually.
Well, John Tudor, we are grateful for you taking time today to speak with us for our Sabre oral history.